This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
Today's episode of the Elevate Podcast is being brought to you by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is award-winning case management software used to manage personal injury, medical malpractice, MDL, class action law firms all over the United States. Great program, highly recommend it. Check them out at smartadvocate.com. Today's episode is being brought to you by Expert Institute. Expert Institute is the place to go for everything involving experts to help you win your case. Check them out at expertinstitute.com. And today's episode is being brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal is a one-stop shop for all of your digital marketing needs. Check them out at hypelegal.com.
Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. I'm Rahul Ravipudi.
And I'm Ben Gideon.
Ben, thank you for sending this to me in the mail. I really appreciate it. The Education of Kendrick Perkins. I know your brother wrote it. I'm going to be reading it, but thank you so much for this.
Oh, you're welcome. I hope you enjoy it. It's a good read.
How did he actually get to meet Kendrick?
So my brother, he's an author. He's written several novels, but all the others are fiction. And he just had this concept idea. It kind of came out of the Colin Kaepernick protest movement of writing a sports biography that focused more on social and racial justice issues, but used the person's story to help explore those issues. And my brother's a big fan of the NBA and really likes listening to Perk and his takes on ESPN. And so he actually pitched this idea through his agent, and Perk loved the idea. So that's kind of the genesis of it. It just kind of came out of left field. And then they spent a lot of time together. My brother went to Houston, Texas, and spent time with Perk and many hours over the course of a year or two. And so the book really is, it's an interesting format because my brother, you can see there, is listed as an author. This isn't a ghost-written biography, and if you read it, you'll see there's a lot of... My brother's a historian by training, and there's a lot of history, both of the NBA and of racism in the American South. So history book, it's part social science, and it's part, I would say, probably at least two-thirds NBA basketball history, and then just all the stuff about, you know, specific games and strategies and the 2008 season where Perk was a starter on the Celtics team that won the NBA title that year with KG and Paul Pierce and Ray Allen. And Perk has an amazing story. He's one of the only NBA players in that era that didn't go to college. He and LeBron were the two, the kind of big guys who never went to college. And Perk grew up playing with LeBron in the summer leagues and all of that. And then after the Celtics era, he then went to OKC, where he played with Durant and Russell Westbrook. Then he went over to Cleveland and played with LeBron. So the guys, like, you can tell a lot of the history of the NBA, recent NBA, through Perk, because he's been in all of those different areas. So it's pretty cool to see that and read about it in the book. So, yeah, if anyone's interested, check it out. Education of Kendrick Perkins by Kendrick Perkins and Seth Rogoff, who happens to be my brother.
It's awesome.
So with that, that's longer than we typically go, but I'd like to welcome Monty Tynes to the podcast today. Monty is a trial lawyer from Pascagoula. Did I say that right?
Pascagoula.
Pascagoula, Mississippi. I think you're our first guest on the show from Mississippi, so welcome.
I'm glad to be here. I'm a big fan. I've listened to all the episodes. Can't wait for each one of them to come out. So when's the next one coming out?
Yours will be out on Monday.
Great.
So Monty, we first met, I think, at TLU in Las Vegas, and one of the things I really like about you is that you seem like someone who's really into honing the craft and learning. And I know you've been trying, you've been on a torrid pace of trying lots of cases. Some you've won great results and some you've lost, but you're putting yourself out there and trying cases in a really hard state to get verdicts. So I commend you on that. But I know you, you're a second generation trial lawyer. You are in a practice that I think that was started by your dad, right?
Yeah, my dad's a lawyer. He retired in 2013. So, but we practiced law from 2006 to 2013 together. He started out in the Mississippi Delta during the Civil Rights Movement, working for legal services. He did a lot of really, really, really interesting things. He sued the state of Mississippi a bunch of times. He got kids. One of the lawsuits was responsible for getting kids out of the prison system and into a youth court system. So he moved back home to the Mississippi Gulf Coast and worked for established legal services in Jackson County, where I practice law now, and then moved into private practice, mostly doing commercial litigation, but all kinds of litigation, divorce. Didn't really do much criminal defense work, but did some personal injury. I grew up working, coming to this office and working in this office. I remember the day that this building, which is the second oldest building in Pascagoula, back when it used to be called the town of Scranton, and the whole town burned except for two buildings, and this is one of them. And when my dad bought this building and we moved in, I was, I was eight, and I helped move in. This has been a large, large part of my life. So I'm just happy to continue going on. And hopefully, you know, my oldest son is taking the LSAT on Friday, so maybe he'll get to carry it on.
Congrats. And you actually have four children, so if he drops the ball, you have three other opportunities, right?
Yeah, I'm quite certain at least two or three of them are going to try to become lawyers. They're pretty successful at everything they do, so I don't think that'll get them.
So what types of cases do you focus on your recent tear? Have they been criminal defense cases or personal injury cases? What was the mix?
We pretty much solely focus on personal injury. We do a lot of medical malpractice, some products liability, and kind of getting out of the normal day-to-day car wreck. But we still have a good number of car wrecks, uninsured motorist claim cases in the office. Where I kind of got my start in personal injury stuff was governmental litigation, where I would sue schools for kids getting hurt. And I sued our sheriff here in Jackson County like 14 times before he eventually was arrested and convicted of various felonies. So that's kind of how I started getting, I guess, more into the personal injury realm.
Did you have a sort of instinctual belief that your sheriff was a bad person before he actually was convicted of being a bad person?
So I was for 11 years the Ocean Springs City Prosecutor, which is we prosecute DUIs and stuff. Now I'm the Ocean Springs City Judge. I got appointed in January. So with that, I had a lot of contact and involvement with law enforcement. And I built a pretty good rapport with the law enforcement. And my wife at the time, she was an assistant district attorney as well. And she's an amazing, amazing trial lawyer. Actually, is a assistant federal public defender now. And recently had a really, really, really big win in the Fifth Circuit on a Second Amendment claim on Daniels versus U.S. So with us kind of being involved in law enforcement, we had good relationships with them and with a lot of officers, and they would come and tell us the really kind of, you know, not good things that were going on in the Jackson County Sheriff's Department, which in turn, you know, I started suing Mike Byrd because of constitutional violation, sexual harassment, a bunch of other things. And at the same time, my wife's office indicted him on, I think, 31 counts of misappropriation and violating people's constitutional rights. And then the feds indicted him in Mobile for constitutional violation of abusing somebody that was in custody. So on a chase that led him into Alabama territory.
Well, it can't be easy to take on the local sheriff. Is that something that for a time you had to worry about your safety and security there?
Yeah, it was interesting. We had a marked car parked across the street of our house for a couple of years. So
was that surveilling you or did you have it there for protection?
No, it was a marked sheriff's department car. I don't know why it was there.
Intimidation.
There was nobody in it or anything like that. It was.
Well,
I don't. It may have just been by happenstance, but it made me nervous.
I've read most of John Grisham's stuff. So do you ever feel like you're living out the John Grisham novel there?
Oh, no, not at all.
But is he from Mississippi?
Yeah, he's from North Mississippi. He, went to Ole Miss Law School where, I went, my wife and my dad went. And I think he still has a house up in Oxford, although I think he's a pretty big Mississippi State fan and went to undergrad at Mississippi State. So, a lot of his books are set in Mississippi or Memphis area.
But the one based on you hasn't been written yet.
Yeah, I don't think there ever will be one.
So I'm curious. You
I lost most of those sheriff cases, by the way. So I did win one, but we suffered a lot of lumps on those.
So you recently had a pretty good verdict in a motor vehicle case where you tried it in a conservative venue and got almost $1 million verdict. Can you tell us a little bit about that case?
Yeah. So Brown versus Keys, we tried it about a month and a half ago. It was a rear-end collision that there was no property damage to either vehicle. My client, Mozella Brown, wonderful, wonderful human being. I've actually known her since 2006. I actually represented her on a workers' comp claim in 2006. And I've represented her or her family members for roughly 17 years. And just a wonderful human being. And she was volunteering for a senior program because she was, because of the workers' comp injury that she suffered in 2006, she could no longer work as a registered nurse. And so, but she wanted to contribute to society. So she was volunteering in a seniors program for seniors that couldn't do stuff for themselves. So she would go help them with household chores, stuff like that. On this day, she was taking an elderly gentleman that was in his 90s to go get a haircut. And there was some construction going on this two-lane road, or that's right close to Ocean Springs football stadium, the Greyhound Stadium. And she was stopped in the traffic for that was stopped by the construction. And then she was rear-ended by Janet Keith. And they got out of the car, surveyed the damage, which there was none. The gentleman that was, it was actually his car that Ms. Brown was driving. He told Ms. Keith she could go ahead and leave. So she left. And Ms. Brown, the gentleman to go get his haircut, dropped him off back at his house, got in her car, went to the police station, and did a police report. She had a pre-existing lower lumbar surgery and had kind of 9 to 10 years of pain management treatment. And the next morning, she started feeling stiff and starting to feel the effects of the wreck and went to the ER. So that's kind of the genesis of the lawsuit.
So how'd you get a Mississippi jury to give you almost $1 million in a case where there was no property damage and your client didn't even go to the hospital from the scene of the wreck?
Well, I think we're not allowed to talk to jurors. So we have specific rules that prevent from talking to jurors. So I haven't been able to ask any of them exactly why they did that. But it came down to a number of things. One, Mississippi has some really good law on the eggshell doctrine about pre-existing injuries and aggravation of the pre-existing injuries. So we got a really good jury instruction for that in the end. But basically, we tried this case with the theme or frame of that they violated the law and we're looking for a free pass. Not necessarily on the defendant's actions, but on how they were defending the case and how the defense was defending the case. We put on a really, really quick trial. I don't think any witness on their direct examination was more than 25 minutes. Most of them were shorter than that. We started on a Tuesday and we finished voir dire in the morning. We probably only did the whole voir dire process, probably took, including the judge's voir dire, an hour and a half or 2 hours. Then we opening statements were before lunch. And after lunch, we started with the evidence. But we framed it around that they were, you know, with everything that they were just looking for a free pass. They violated the law and they were looking for a free pass. So that's kind of how we framed the case and how we presented each and every witness.
So then on that case, did you identify any sort of steps or missteps the defense took that maybe helped you out a little bit?
Yeah, so they, of course, hired a DME or IME. That was an orthopedic surgeon that with a fellowship in spine surgery. His position was he suffered a sprained strain, and it was healed within 6 to 8 weeks or 6, 8 to 12 weeks or something like that. And that miraculously she healed. And then the pre-existing condition of the degenerative disc disease got her. And it came up and got her. And immediately after she healed up from this wreck, that the pre-existing condition made all the other discs in her lower lumbar and her cervical region start bulging. And that's kind of how they presented the case.
Crazy how that happens in almost every spine injury case, just spontaneously.
Yeah, every single time somebody gets in a wreck, they heal up from the wreck, but then the pesky degenerative disc disease gets them.
Is that kind of how you argued it? Because that was pretty effective the way you just explained that and made it sound pretty disingenuous for them to take that position. Would the jury, you think, polarize them on that issue that they were annoyed that the defense was playing games?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, we had a number of medical providers. And because Ms. Brown had lower lumbar surgery before that did not do well, she suffered a long time from the after effects of that microdiscectomy that she had. She didn't have a fusion in 2007, but it did not turn out well. She wanted to avoid surgery in any way possible. So she went to great lengths to try to do everything she possibly could not to have surgery. So she did physical therapy. She did chiropractic care. And she saw multiple different neurosurgeons who all said, really, the only way that we can try to minimize the pain that you're in and these other symptoms that you're having is to do surgery. But she was like, can we try something else? And she fought really hard to try to get better without doing surgery. And the surgery was actually 3 years post-wreck that she finally capitulated and was like, I can't handle this anymore. I can hardly move. I got to do something. So one of the things we did is we showed in the medical records where we had 6, 7, 8 medical providers that all said she had an aggravation of a pre-existing medical condition caused by the wreck. And it was like, and it like matched up with the jury instructions. So we just hammered that like over and over and over again. And again, we had somebody that was, while they did have this injury before, they had pain management treatment. The year prior to the wreck in 2016, she went to see that pain management doctor one time. So in June of 2016. This wreck happened in January the 27th of 2017. So the entire year before, she had one medical visit. And so when you look at a calendar of the year with a dot on the June 6th or whatever date she went and compare it to 2016, 17, 18, 19, where it's like lit up with dots on all the medical visits, on all the different medical providers she's trying to get pain relief from. It just doesn't make any sense that this wreck didn't have any effect on her at all.
We'd like to thank the sponsors of the Elevate podcast, Steno, national court reporting service that allows trial lawyers to defer the costs of court reporting until the end of the case. Take a look, steno.com, and by Law Pods. Law Pods is the podcast production company that we use to produce the show, that produces podcasts for lawyers all over the country. They have an expertise in podcasting and the law. Check them out at lawpods.com.
I know you're a real student of the practice, and you're always working to get better, learn new techniques. Are there things that you've developed over the last bunch of years that you implemented, you think, in that case that helped you out? And one thing you mentioned was the very brief witness examinations. Is that something you are consciously doing now to shorten the case, or did it just happen to work out that way?
Yeah, so I'm the co-dean of the Edge Damages College, but also, I mean, I try to, so I've been through all the Edge Reptile stuff, all the colleges. I watch tons and tons and tons of stuff on CBN and with TLU. And one of the things that hit home with me, particularly, is Joe Fried and speed trial. And just in Mississippi, we're kind of forced to, like, at least where we are, our judges are constant, like, we're getting this over with. You're going move, 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 move. So it fits kind of with what we are required to do. And also, my attention span's shorter. My kids' attention span's even shorter. And one of the things that I discovered by sitting on the bench, because we have bench trials instead of for misdemeanors and tickets and DUIs and stuff like that, it's really hard for me to sit up there and pay attention to a 20-minute trial or a 30-minute trial versus these poor folks get stuck for days or weeks or whatever the trial is. All those things come together, and we cannot have even a second of wasted space when we're taking 12 people's time out of whatever they're doing. So we have to be very, very respectful of them. And I don't think I objected not once during the trial. Well, actually, I take that back. I did object once, and I immediately regretted it because I don't want them sitting around while we're not doing anything. That's not relevant to the situation.
So how does that play out in cross-examination? Are you even shorter in cross?
Yeah, well, the one area, we only had two witnesses that we crossed in this case because, I mean, total, we had the defendant. We called the defendant first, then we played our neurosurgeon deposition. That lasted about an hour. We were about 20 minutes and they were about 40 on the cross-examination. And then we called three before and after witnesses and we called our client. The defendants called defendant driver and their spine surgeon. I think, you know, with cross-examination, we may have been 30, 35 minutes on that. It could have been tighter, and we will make it tighter going forward. There's no question. One of the things that I learned is I thought we were being extremely fast compared to all the other trials that I had, like extremely fast. But the judge did talk to the jurors afterwards. And, you know, I asked in front of the counsel office, I asked, you know, what did you learn anything about, you know, how we good, bad, whatever we did. And what he said, even though this trial was done in basically less than a day, it's less than 8 hours. If you take out voir dire, he said that the attorney's too much time messing with stuff.
Amazing.
The only time that I can think where I didn't have an exhibit ready for direct or cross or anything like that, I wanted to get the actual exhibit that was going out with them on the map of where it happened. And so I was looking through the exhibits, which we had like 12 or 14 exhibits, and trying to find the actual one that they were going to have and put it up on the Elmo. And that took maybe like 40 seconds. I mean, it didn't even take a full minute. So just from their perspective, they were like, hey, the attorneys, they wasted too much time going through the evidence, like getting stuff together. So I was just like, I don't know how I can make it any quicker but I'll do my best.
So you mentioned you're the co-chair of the Edge Trial College. What is kind of what's the cutting edge stuff that you guys are teaching now?
Yeah, so I'm the Damages College, I'm that. And that's just trying to basically figure out your how to present your damages, you know, your witnesses, your damaged witnesses. What are the drivers of verdicts and stuff like that? So we just mostly try to impress upon them of how to go find that evidence and then how to present the damages evidence. In this case, one of the things that we were very conscious of, and one of the things that we had to show that this didn't just affect Mozella's life, Miss Brown's life, it affected kind of the whole family, which Miss Brown was in her late 60s. So you know, her son's grown up and has kids of his own and all that kind of stuff. So we wanted to make sure that we weren't complaining about having her complain about all the problems that she was having. So we had other people talk about what she was like before and then what she was like afterwards. And we had her talk about what the effect this has had on her son and her friends and how she went from somebody that was helping people, that she was volunteering 3 or 4 days a week to help people that couldn't help themselves, to needing other people when her son was out of town working, because he worked offshore. So he was on a month, off a month and stuff like that. Her son had to give up. He moved from Houston back home to Goshen, Mississippi to help take care of his mom after he saw when he came home and saw the condition she was in. Her best friend, who was a nurse practitioner, who they had plans to go when her nurse practitioner friend retired to go on a cruise to Alaska, how she could no longer do that stuff, and how this friend who they used to go window shopping and dinner and stuff like that, like weekly, that they didn't do that anymore at all. And the only time this friend spent with her was taking her to the grocery store or coming to help her, you know, bathe and stuff like that. So we made it a real point of not having Miss Brown talk about, oh, poor, pitiful me. And she was actually a very uplifting person. And she realized the effect that her injury had on her son and had some guilt associated with that. And her motto was, I'm going to do better. I'm going to do better to try to help my son, to help myself, to help my son. So, and that's kind of how we left it with it at the end of evidence and then at the end of closing, with an uplifting message that she is still fighting to try to do better.
Just on your trial efficiency and trying to try the case faster, I just came back from the CALA convention in Las Vegas, a plaintiff attorney convention, and I heard somebody say that they believed the faster the trial, the better the outcome for the plaintiff. Is that like a trending belief that's going on right now?
I believe it, because I suffered a really, really bad loss on a case that hit me really hard, where we took too long. I think that played a small part, but a part in it. It was a birth injury case where we had video of the malpractice, where it was a breech C-section and the doctor hyperextended the baby's neck and she was paralyzed from the chest down. And we took 5 days on that trial, and we had a lot of time where we wasted in that. So I personally believe that if you have that time that you're wasting in there, and that they're always going to blame the plaintiff. They're going to blame the plaintiff for anything they can possibly do that. And recently, I had a MedMal trial that I lost 2 weeks ago, where we didn't have any delays, but there were significant delays in the trial that they couldn't attribute to either party. And I mean, that was directly related, you know, in front of the jury. But I feel pretty confident that kind of weighed negatively. So, and in that trial, it was a 3.5 day trial. It should have been a 1.5 day trial. As far as the evidence goes, I mean, we had 5 witnesses. So it should have never taken 3.5 days.
But if it took 1.5 days instead of 3.5, do you think the outcome would have been different?
Not in that case. Probably not, because we were fighting some other things. I've told Ben about it. And it was an informed consent case that we were kind of fighting an uphill battle on it to begin with. But it definitely played a negative role and made it harder to win. I feel for certain. about that.
Would that case you were also fighting against a hostile judge, as I recall?
Yeah, it was not a fun experience. Next time I do go in front of a judge like that, I'm going to take some blood beta blockers to try to keep my blood pressure down. It was not a fun experience. I mean, every jury trial, even like that, they are kind of fun. You learn a lot out of them. I think I learned a lot out of that case. But we had some, you know, I wasn't allowed to ask the panel on an informed consent case for a uvulectomy if what their experience, what if they knew what the word informed consent was during board eye. So, you know, that was interesting.
What? Tell us your, you now are doing more medical malpractice. I don't know if it's exclusively what you're doing, but you're doing a higher percentage of your practice. Definitely sounds like a very tough venue to be trying med mal cases. Why are you moving in that direction?
Well, there's nobody in Mississippi's doing it. And since I've been practicing law since 2015, has seen a precipitous drop in the quality of medical care that we're getting. And if you can't find somebody to hold doctors accountable for when they egregiously mess up and they cut somebody's uvula out without anything in the medical record saying that they were going to do it, that they did it, or without a written informed consent, whether I lose that case or not, the right thing to do is try to hold that doctor accountable for doing that. So maybe, just maybe, the next time he goes to do a tonsillectomy and he's going to perform a uvulectomy as well, that he's going to actually get that damn consent form signed. It's tough living to earn in Mississippi, but it's more about we have to have somebody that's going to do that here. And I can hold up on one hand the number of lawyers in Mississippi that I know for a fact do med mal cases that aren't some horrific, super bad case, you know, like that anybody would take, you know. So it's something that I feel like I have to do.
So I wanted to ask you a couple of questions on two different things you brought up, but one is you've recently faced a hostile judge. Can you share with us some of the reasons why you believed he was a hostile judge? And then how do you interact or manage such a situation if you can?
Yeah, the first one, I'm not real good at it because I'm trying to get better. I'm trying to do some yoga or, you know, meditation to get, you know, but I inherited from my dad kind of a bad temper. So sometimes my reaction is not the best, but I'm working on it. I'm trying to get better. So one of the things that is, it doesn't show up in the record is the body language and the tone in which the judge speaks to, which is paramount to how we perceive things, how we as individuals. I mean, I can tell is the moment I walk in the room how my night's going to go without my wife saying a word. So in body language is super important. What you put off, how you absorb whatever's going on in the situation. And if a judge is constantly or overruled instead of overruled, that, in my opinion, has an effect. If while the words that they use that are on the transcript seem like normal every day, the way they use those words can have a significant effect to how the jury perceives the parties, to how the jury perceives the counsel, to how the jury perceives the actual case that's in front of the judge. It's become a realization in the last like 6 or 8 months. And I've gone in front of some really wonderful judges. The turnover that we've had here in the bench in Jackson County just makes trial experience, it's a stressful experience, more relaxed and easier because our job's hard in and of itself. We don't need somebody breathing down our neck and sighing and like talking to us in a manner like we're not worthy or we're stupid or what we're doing is stupid. It's just, there's no place. And I haven't figured out the appropriate remedy to try to remedy that situation. So I'm going to work on that.
Do you think that hostility comes from, in some cases, the judge just not identifying with the cause that you're bringing before them, like they're anti-plaintiff or anti-medical malpractice or don't like the case? Or what do you think is underlying the hostility you've perceived?
Yeah, I think it's different with every single judge. Some of them just don't like being in trial. I mean, just they've got, you know, in Mississippi, the judges that handle personal injury cases that are over $200,000 in state court also have handled criminal cases. So the overwhelming majority of their docket and the things they're more concerned about are their criminal docket. So in any second they spend handling a personal injury case is a second they're not handling their criminal docket, and they're taking away. And from that, in almost every single, like I'd say 90% or more, maybe 95% of the judges that I'm in front of are former prosecutors. So they already have a bias into which type of case is more important. But it could be a number of factors. And I think that's the part that if we can convince the bench, all these cases are important. And the way you present yourself from the bench it puts your thumb on the scale. And it provides one party or the other with an unfair advantage, even though you may not realize you're doing it or, you know, have an intent to do that. Because I don't think that particular judge and some of the other judges had an intent to sway the outcome of the case. But our actions, regardless of what our intent is, they have consequences. And I've lost plenty of cases that we had perfectly wonderful, kind judges, you know. And I've won cases where we've had hostile judges. It's not impossible, but I do think it puts something into the trial that is just not there. It's not what the purpose of the system.
Yeah. Has either of you been, Monty, have either of you actually talked to the judge and said what you just said, Monty, which is, hey, Your Honor, I think the jury really likes you and respects you. And it seems like you're in front of the jury projecting some negative energy towards my side, intentionally or unintentionally. And I just wanted to bring that up.
Yeah. So this is kind of a new revelation the last like 6 months or 8 months, maybe, that I've come to. And it may just be false, but I don't think it is. Now, a friend of mine, about five or six years ago, tried a car wreck case. And he contacted some of the jurors. And they told him that the way the judge acted towards that counsel, they thought that he hated the counsel. So that lawyer approached the judge about it. And the judge got extremely, extremely offended. And he's retired now, but I do know that he ended up recusing himself of all of that lawyer's cases later. But he did not appreciate the constructive criticism that he was approached with. So, but he, knowing that lawyer, he might have not have said it in the way that you just did.
The way Rahul just said it was great, but you'd have to take all the emotion out of it in order to get to a place where you could be as kind and approaching as he did. So Monty, in the minutes remaining, what are you looking to as you look toward the future and cases that you're working up and trials you've got coming up? What are you looking to, how are you going to advance the ball? Do you have strategies or plans in place to keep growing and improving as a lawyer? And what, if so, what are those? Because I'm sure everybody who listens would like to know how to do it for themselves.
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the things is you got to, you know, I mean, it doesn't matter what you do. You've got to keep learning. You have to broaden your mind into know that what we do every day with the pleadings and the discovery and all that kind of stuff, really, that doesn't help you not even a little bit in trial and how to present a case. And you've got to absorb as much as you possibly can. Like a TLU is just a wonderful, wonderful tool to do that, because on the website, you get, and I probably consume probably, I don't know, anywhere from 5 to 10 hours a week of people presenting. While I went to TLU in Las Vegas in 2022, where I watched you and Josh and Lloyd Bell present on MedMail, and I watched every second of that, I have probably watched it at least 3 times, every bit of what y'all presented since then. I've watched Rolls, your presentation on the casino case, in the opening statement, the voir dire, and everything that you did in the casino case with your client that suffered the brain injury. Because, you know, I mean, I've got 2 cases against casinos in the future. I tried one in May. We got a verdict. We got a wonderful, huge plaintiff's verdict for $0. So against the Boer Vodge on a false arrest case. So I wish I would have watched some of your stuff beforehand to try to implement it, but I've got another one against that same defendant with a pretty severe injury of a high roller, just like you had in that case. So you got to learn, and you also have to practice your stuff. You have to practice, and you have to practice, and you have to practice. Giving opening statements has not, or closing statements or whatever, has not been easy. I make my entire office, all my secretaries, paralegals, and Courtney Wilson, my associate, she's wonderful, listen to my opening statements over and over and over and critique me. Sometimes I have to leave the room when they write out the critiques and then go back and listen to them later on. I make all my kids listen to me and watch the stuff. I do a practice board hour on them. They don't even know I'm doing it in the car when I'm taking them to school. You can't practice enough this stuff, because that's the only way you're going to get good at making a connection with your members and driving home. I gave closing statements in my car all the time. I called my very first plaintiff's verdict that I got was in 2015 on a sexual harassment case. And I gave my closing statement 4 times on my way home from work at like 7 or 8 o'clock at night to my brother on the phone, like I was talking on my Bluetooth. You can never do enough practice. And you got to listen to the criticism and start trying to change some of the things that aren't hitting home with people. And we also do focus groups and all that kind of stuff. But it's just, that's my key.
Yeah, that's very well stated, and probably the best advice you could give to anyone is just like anything else, you got to practice. Well, thanks so much, Monty, for joining us. We really enjoyed this and appreciate it. And hope we can stay in touch.
Well, thank y'all, and I might be bugging the heck out of y'all, but I'm definitely going to stay in touch.
Oh, thanks so much, Monty.
Thank y'all.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.